G'day, Indy Wood is my name, and this is The Local Update, a podcast looking at local issues, events, and personalities from around the Bega Valley. On this week's episode, after 16 years of hard work from the Trust of the Old Bega Hospital and the Friends of the Old Bega Hospital Committee, the funding has finally been announced in the last little while. $3 million available to rebuild the badly damaged venue. We'll catch up with Val Little and Richard Bomford, committee members from the Friends of the Old Bega Hospital, talk about what that money means and where to from here. That's all coming up on this episode of The Local Update. And of course, as we do each week, we'll catch up with local history buff, Mr. Graham Farram. On last week's episode, Graham spoke about the community of Wollumla. And he talked in passing about the sleeper cutter industry that was happening in that region, supplying sleepers to railroads. This week, he looks further at those sleeper cutters and what that industry meant to the region.
I've been looking at Wollumla and I found a couple of other tales in Tales of the Far South Coast, volumes 1 and 2. There were both things in it. But when I was reading volume 1, which is November 1982, a little while back, an excellent story by the late Ron Stafford on sleeper cutting. Now, Ron's also written a book called Foundations of the Past, the history of the Stafford family and brickmaking. And if you actually go out to Kallaroo, where the old brickworks are, where Staffords have their building supplies, you still might be able to buy a copy straight off the counter out there. And it's the most charming book, and I might be able to do some of that later. But this is Sleeper Cutting by Ron Stafford. It's pages 39 and 40 of Tales of the Far South Coast, Volume 1. Sleeper cutting was a major source of employment on the Far South Coast for over half a century. In the decades 1960-70, however, the trade had dwindled to almost a dribble, possibly due to the lack of suitable stands of timber being available to cut sleepers from, and alternative employment being available to timber cutters in the wood chip business. It would be a fair comment to say the golden years of sleeper cutting will be during the Depression years of the 1930s. It was during this era that timber workers from Victoria came to the south coast of New South Wales to join with local workers in the sleeper cutting industry. Wood stands of hardwood were readily available from local forests, and there being no quota systems, cutters could earn acceptable incomes by working long hours. Cutters had to have a licence issued by the Forestry Commission, to whom they paid royalty per sleeper cut. The cutter also had to pay to have the sleepers carted from the forest to the dump, which was usually adjacent to the wharves at Eden, Merimbula, Tartha and Bermagui. Each month or 5 weeks, there would be a sleeper pass when an inspector from the New South Wales Railways would come to the appropriate dump and inspect all the sleepers before payment was presented to the cutters. It was not uncommon for some sleepers to be rejected, but there was usually a ready demand for reject sleepers by the public, the fence posts, etc. Large quantities of sleepers were exported to New Zealand, and among the ships to load sleepers at Tartha were SS Abel Tasman, the Kaori, and a large ship named the Port Waikato. The skipper of the Port Waikato had many anxious moments when loading at Tartha Wharf because of insufficient depth of water at low tide to float his ship, and as a result, the ship used Eden Port on later voyages. As a matter of interest, the SS Abel Tasman in later years took part in Antarctic operations. A further ship named the Charlie Dan also loaded sleepers from Eden Port for export to Pakistan. During the golden years of sleeper cutting, the cutter's toolkit comprised cross-cut saw, hammer and wedges, broad axe, a bar, and its gauge and string line. In later years, mechanisation took some of the toil from the business with the introduction of chainsaws, and some cutters built up circular saws for the sawing of sleepers. The famous old Army Blitz wagon was also an asset for winching logs from steep gullies and slopes. Mr. Joe Caddy, who has just retired from the New South Wales Forestry Commission and was, in fact, a professional bushman and sleeper cutter, has quoted the following statistics. One man could produce, on an average, 7 to 8 sleepers per day, and a perfect-sized tree was one which would produce about 30 sleepers. Mr. Caddy said the largest tree he felled during his sleeper cutting career was a blackbutt in the forest known as the Desert in the Wallagoot Lake District. This tree produced over 100 sleepers, but he does not claim this as a record because his late father, Joe Caddy Sr., had talked of forest giants that produced up to 150 sleepers. These huge trees had to be worked by a gang of cutters, being too large for one man to handle, because the diameter of the tree at ground level could be almost 6 feet. When the steamer trade to the far south coast of New South Wales finished in the early 1950s, the sleeper cutting industry rapidly declined because the government railways would only purchase sleepers on a delivered to railhead basis, which meant cutters had to deliver their sleepers to Bombala or Bomaderry railheads. And this, of course, was not economical. There was, of course, a lesser demand from the coal mining industry. Several species of hardwood timber were used for sleepers, and in order of quality, iron box was first, followed by red gum, box, woolly butt, black butt, and stringy bark. In New Zealand, the railways are now treating softwoods for use as sleepers. Maybe the Australian railway system may think likewise. It is apparent that our stands of mature hardwoods are being harvested faster than they can regenerate. Substitutes for railway sleepers have been carried out, and reinforced concrete and steel were among the experiments. But as far as I know, the hardwood sleeper still predominates. Sleepers for government railways are still cut in large quantities from Western River red gums and also on the north coast of New South Wales. Thanks, Ron. In the same book, at Volume 1, Tales of the Far South Coast, pages 58 and 9, there's a story by Sadie Mead. I'm only going to give parts of it, but this is Bermagui from 1938 on. We were recovering from the dreadful depression, and there were whisperings of a coming war in Europe. The main industries in our town and close by were deep sea fishing, sleeper cutting, dairy farming, and net fishing in Wallaga Lake and other small lakes. There was also a timber mill employing about 16 to 18 men, and a wattle bark mill. War broke out in Europe, and many of our men joined the forces to fight overseas. The Japanese submarines got amongst the convoy of ships off Bermagui, and quite a lot of wreckage was washed up on the beaches around the town. In the late 1940s, corvette building for the Navy started up on the bank of the Bermagui River. In the early 1950s, New Zealand started buying 7-foot sleepers from New South Wales, and many were cut and sent from here. The smaller boats coming to pick them up could lie at our wharf, but others had to be transported to Eden for the larger ships berthing there. This order was finally dropped in 1956-7. The bigger crew was working the mill, but the wattle bark industry was fading out. As time marched on, sleeper cutting also declined. Today, there are only 5 men cutting sleepers, and several others with small wood mills scattered throughout the bush, cutting a few sleepers and timber. In an earlier tale in the same volume titled History of Bermagui and District, research by Bertha Davidson. We read on page 19. It is reported that timber from Bermagui was used in the building of the Sydney GPO, and a big industry in Wollobar was established by Brearley Brothers of Geelong and sleepers with the firm of Alan Taylor. Page 20. Gradually, with the development of the internal combustion, motor transport began to usurp the steamer's position as the most economical means of transport. As efficient road systems extended further south from Sydney, so did the shipping routes dwindle. The last ISN boat came to Bermagui in 1952. The most common cargoes were pigs and sleepers. Because of the noise they made as they pulled into the harbour, the boats were often known as the pigs and whistles. In a survey of towns in Swinburne and Winter's Pictorial History, Big Valley Shire, page 109, we find, proclaimed in 1872, Bermagui was established as a port for Cobargo's Wattlebar, sleeper cutting, sawmilling and dairy industry. On page 49 in an earlier section on shipping, it is recorded, tens of thousands of sleepers were loaded from Bermagui Wharf, having been stacked for inspection on Sleeper Dump Hill, now known as Port Dickinson. Speaking directly of the Illawarra and South Coast Steam Navigation Company on page 50, we learn the availability of a reliable, scheduled cargo and passenger shipping service created a positive effect throughout the farming and business community. Also, shipment of cargo and livestock provided the primary source of income. Prime beef cattle, sheep, timber, butter, cheese, wattlebar, corn, most importantly, pigs. Page 53, when the steamship Beagle was lost off Bunga Head in April 1908, cargo also included more than 2,000 cheeses, 176 pigs, furniture, bags of wattlebar, tanned leather from Spencer's Beagle Tannery, mailbags, gold coin, and 10 3/4 tons of butter. Both Ron Stafford and Sadie Mead spoke of the trials of the Great Depression. Rabbit trapping and wattlebark stripping often went hand in hand. Page 85. Trappers traded their summertime labour for the privilege of trapping on a farmer's land in winter. In the warmer months, they frequently turned to wattlebark stripping, an activity best carried out during the summer. On private property, landowners claimed half the proceeds for the bark. Page 92. Another home industry is recorded under the heading The Good Oil. Prolific around Toowoomba and Wyndham, the black peppermint, or Eucalyptus australiana, supported hundreds of families. A peppermint-flavoured oil distilled from these trees was highly valued by the Faldings organisation for treating common colds and respiratory disorders. The greatest volumes of oil were distilled in autumn, winter, and late summer after spring's new growth matured. At Wyndham, the cutters were known as monkey starters, koalas having been known as monkeys in the early days. In lean times, eucalyptus distillers employed any person with the strength and motivation to cut leaves and use a horse and slide to deliver. During World War II, a 44-gallon drum of oil delivered to an Eden shipping agent earned around £120. In Tales of the Far South Coast, Volume 2, April 1984, pages 94 and 5, W.R. Mitchell gives a personal account of distilling eucalyptus oil in the Wyndham and Toowoomba and Lower Toowoomba districts. He says, eucalyptus oil distilled from black peppermint is much stronger than any bought from shops. We were not troubled by colds or flu while operating the distillery. Eucalyptus oil is also the best method to loosen nasty nuts that I know of. The Windermere provided more oil than we did at Lower Toowoomba. And certainly some Wyndham people would have more experience in eucalyptus than I have. Kaji, inland from Badala, provided a large amount of oil from black peppermint. I'm told some distilling is still carried on at Yowrie, near Cobarga. Thermagui, A Century of Features and Families by Ron Gahar and Judy Hearn, 1994, page 81, Timber. Railway sleepers. China and New Zealand constantly sought Australian sleepers because of their quality and durability. But orders from China were finished by 1934. Page 82. Edgar Jaggers told the following story in May 1992. He says, in part, I cut my first sleeper in 1925, aged 18, and retired from sleeper cutting in 1957. During the Depression in the 1930s, only a married man could get a sleeper cutter's license. Those days, I would cut sleepers on Crown land, and sometimes private. I would set up a camp on the chosen site in a tent, and later a wooden hut with an iron roof and a 450-litre galvanised tank made by Sam Sinclair. The horse teams that took the sleepers out brought back supplies which were fairly basic. For example, potatoes, pumpkin, rice, corned beef, but no fruit or green vegetables as they didn't keep too well. Besides, were too expensive. I lived in the bush 5 weeks at a time. Page 83. Each sleeper had his own brand, either a letter or a number, embossed on a steel punch, which was hammered into each sleeper for the inspector to see. Edgar Jaggers used the number 12.
Graham Farram puts together a segment for each episode of this podcast, The Local Update. He's a member of Bega's Historical Society and involved with the Bega Pioneers Museum. We record these segments with Graham in the foyer of the Bega Pioneers Museum each Monday morning around 11 o'clock, and you're more than welcome to join us there. You're listening to The Local Update, a podcast looking at local issues, events and personalities from around the Bega Valley. This podcast is produced by Indie Media, and all info on each of the episodes available from indiemedia.com.au. I mentioned in last week's episode that I got my start at this game thanks to the local community radio station here in Bega, 93.7 Edge FM. I started out there at about the age of 8 or 9 in 1990, 91, somewhere around there, and I was involved with them heavily right up until 2004. Edge FM studios are based in the old Bega Hospital site just outside town, and so I spent quite a lot of time out there. While I was involved with Edge FM in 2004, there was a big fire at the old Bega Hospital, and the main building was more or less ruined. So it's amazing to learn that that building remains in that state today. It's great to hear, though, that 16 years later, finally, the state government have come through with $3 million in funding that will allow the committee to rebuild the building and get the community centre that was operational there back on its feet. I caught up with two of the members of the Friends of the Old Bega Hospital Committee, Val Little and Richard Bomford, recently.
From 1988 until 2004, it was Bega's primary community centre, where all sorts of community groups could meet, store stuff, do art, whatever it was they wanted to do. So it was everything from family daycare to nursing mothers to art classes to take over where the tech left off, all sorts of things along those lines. Until on a windy night in May, like last night we had here, we don't know exactly what happened, but something to do with heaters. Either they were left on or there's an electrical fault or something overloaded and the fire started. Nobody knew about it until it was well away. They managed to save the outbuildings entirely, which was an operating theatre, a laundry, a morgue and the nurses' quarters. So four pretty valuable outbuildings. But the main building was basically gutted. No roof, no floors, very few windows. The very extremities, the eastern end and the western end, there's still bits of roof on those and some floorboards, but they've been exposed to the weather now since 2004 and they're getting pretty ratty. But there's still the building itself, it's made of brick. It's still a beautiful building to look at. It was built by a local builder who also built the police barracks. I think he might have had a hand in the courthouse and various private residences. It's got some architectural merit. The New South Wales chapter of the Royal Institute of Architects listed it as architecture of merit for the state. The local council has recognised its heritage value and it's listed as heritage under the Bega Valley Local Environment Plan. And it's been sitting there waiting for someone to love it and put a roof back on it since 2004.
All right.
The communities continue to use the outbuildings for various purposes, but it's certainly not the thriving hub that it was.
That was the question I was going to ask next, Val, was you mentioned before that you got involved probably in 2006 after hearing about the textiles team out there. So the main building got burnt, but obviously there's been a whole lot of activity going on in those outbuildings still over these years.
There has. We've got the Potters out there. There's radio, the community radio station. The Bega Valley beekeepers have arrived in the last 3 years. The men's shed was opened 2016, and that was when Andrew Constance actually did make an announcement that he was going to make sure the roof got mended, but it was an election year. There's a community group meets out there, a childcare type of group, and various groups. There was an art class there. There was a writing class out there, and various groups book it. I noticed the beekeepers are having a couple of learn how to, look after your bees. That's coming up, hopefully, if they can hold it. The potters have open days. The weavers have open days. So there's quite a few activities that actually go on, and it's needed. And it's not just for older people. In time, we've got our plans for the community garden. We've got plans for a hedge that'll be around, that'll be have native trees and so on, so that there's going to be a community kitchen back in, which there was before the fire. So all of this space that's out there is going to be owned and run by the community. They'll be able to have whatever they want, whatever they choose as a community to go there. So it's happening, but it will happen to a far greater degree. And once that building is restored, it'll be something that we'll all be so proud of, and it will also become a tourist attraction. So, there's a lot happening there, and this is why we open it up with our Raise the Roof. So once a year, all of our community can go out there and just see how the developments are going.
Val, you've spoken already about the community-based fundraising stuff that you've done in the past, and I have heard mentioned that you did things like sat outside Andrew Constance's office saying you were going to knit a roof for the building at some point. How well did that funding stuff go so far?
Well, we respect governments. There's lots of regional areas need money. But, the thing that I and many other people could not get over, that this building, they kept having to have the engineers check it. The fact that it's, as Richard mentioned, a brick building, it is still solid. 15 of the 16, I think it is, chimneys are still standing on what is really a spider web of a bit of few bits of wood because the roof's gone. But because of the nature of the building in those days, the whole thing is structurally sound, but it still needs a roof. You can't go in and do stuff if you haven't got a roof on things. So this, we did decide that Andrew promised the $500,000 and it just didn't eventuate. And then there's reasons for that, I guess. But once we came to the next election, we thought, well, we'll just quietly sit. And it wasn't right outside his office. We wouldn't do that. We actually were selling raffle tickets for one of our fundraisers, which is our travel raffle. And we were doing that anyway. So we just decided that a few of us would sit there and we'd knit the roof as a little bit of... Just to put a little bit of an angle on it. We can't seem to get our roof any other way. So let's knit one. So it was just to get a little bit of publicity out there and a bit of a laugh. And one little boy wanted to ask me what I was doing. And I said, I'm knitting a roof. And I showed him a picture of the hospital. And he said, which was on our travel raffle board. And he said, will it be rainproof?
Very good. Richard, in late 2018, the committee asked for $2.4 million in funding, and in early January you were told that it wasn't going to happen. What happened there?
Well, the funding we applied for was through the Regional Cultural Fund, and it's basically designed to promote the arts. It was the first opportunity we'd had to find the sort of money we required, which was of the order of $3.5 million. But when we applied to the Regional Cultural Fund, we were saying we had to not present it so much as a community centre with all the childcare and all that sort of stuff. We had to reorient the proposal to just be cultural, so sort of the arts. And we presented it as a complement to the more formal infrastructure we've got in the valley. So we've got the Four Winds Festival up in the north. We've got, and their site, we've got the community council's civic centre in Bega. And at that stage, I think funding had been approved for the Twyford Hall in Maribula. There is cultural stuff here, but what was missing, this is the way we put it, what was missing was the community feed into it. So we presented that as the argument. I don't know really why we didn't get funding beyond that, because we had to leave the community side out of it, we're really only presenting 50% of the proposal. And I think that's probably what the real problem was.
But the good news is that in more recent times, the Regional Community Development Fund has come forward and you now have $3 million available, hey?
That is the story. Apparently, the Regional Communities Development Fund is for applications that have failed to get funding under other regional programs. So it turned out we had to have failed to get the cultural money in order to be eligible to get the community money. There was a lot of politicking involved in that. As Val said, people were in the street knitting a roof in frustration. There was toing and froing in the Bega District News. Val mentioned that earlier on we got an offer of $500,000, but it never eventuated. The state election was in the offing at that stage, and Labor said, well, we're going to provide you with $500,000 with no strings attached, because the previous offer of $500,000 had a lot of strings attached, including we had to find the remainder of the $3 million, which was a bit of a tall ask. So we had to provide sort of 5-to-1 matching funding. Finding 1-to-1 matching funding can be pretty hard work. Finding 5-to-1 matching funding for a community group is extraordinarily hard work. Yes, in January, I think it was, Mr. Constance said, well, what's the point of $500,000? We can just put a roof on it for that money, but you still can't use the place. It'd have no floors, doors, windows and electricity. He spoke to Mr. Barilaro, and between the two of them, they said that we will get $3 million. The only difficulty is by that stage, the cost of the proposal was now $3.5 million, and we're $500,000 short. So we put an application into Crown Lands, who actually own the building, They have a funding program which $400,000, $500,000 is a big ask from their funding program. They certainly couldn't have provided the $3 million. But given we had the $3 million, I think various strings were pulled and the Crown Lands program said, right, here's your missing $421,000. So we've now got $421,000, which is $3,421,000, which was the estimate of cost in the quantity survey that we got in September 2018. Of course, the prices have gone up again since then, but we won't know how much it's actually going to cost until we get tenders from builders, provided that it's the bare bones building, that building that council can approve and say, yes, community, you can move in. Everyone's going to be happy.
Val, having been here for long enough, we both know the significance of having access to this building. It must have been hard, though, at times over this period since 2004 to actually engage a community who maybe have never heard of the building before and get them to commit to giving you any money.
What funds we raise really are to be used to put things in the community centre. I mean, once when it's up and going, we'll need a computer. We'll need this, we'll need that for a room, you know, for keeping tabs on things, no doubt, an office type of thing. So our fundraising, when I mentioned not getting a lot of money, it's mainly open up, raise the roof, the community comes, we have the Jewett Fireys, they come in, they give us a donation, but whatever they sell in hot dogs and sausages, they take that money with them. The other groups, the market stalls that come, they pay their market stall fee. If they've had a good day, they give us a bit of a donation. So, but the entertainment, the music, Brett Rogers and his jumping dogs, the face painting people, all of our entertainment, apart from the big blow-up castle thing, all of our entertainment is provided by the community freely. Each year we try to bring in a new group. Like last year we started the Vegemite cooking competition to get the CWA involved with us. Vega Cheese kindly donated some backpacks for prizes. Vega Band were able to slot in half an hour playing for us this year. So each year I look for something that we might be able to add to the Raise the Roof that's bringing in another community group. We had groups like Are You OK? They come, they just have their pamphlets and things for people so that, you know, they advertise what they do in the community. The Friends, we run a chocolate wheel, which is the Tarpa and Business House chocolate wheel, or Vega and Tarpa Business House chocolate wheel. So that's a bit of an old-fashioned bit of entertainment that gets us a few dollars, but all the vouchers and in kind, the business houses all donate. So, you know, which is great. So they're happily involved doing that with us. And then we make money out of the cake stall. Once again, or both of these fundraisers, they're under $1,000, but still it adds up. So the cooks in the valley, I throw out letters to the CWA, to the Red Cross, to, you know, the Lions and ladies and so on, and all men and so on, to any of those groups. I just send out a letter letting them know out. So I'm again this year, the last Saturday in October, you know, any cooking, that'll be great. So once again, our aim is to get the community there. The day goes from 10 till 2, and most of the activities that are going on, if people are raising, community groups are getting a few dollars, the weavers will be selling, the potters are selling, putting things on for children to do. It's like an old-fashioned fete. When we get the roof on and we can then head looking for more sponsors who will, you know, help to keep it going, and we'll have more groups renting and so on, and it'll all work out.
You've mentioned that it was the last weekend in October. I suppose we should talk about the time, etc. Give us the plug on exactly when this event is.
It is the last Sunday in October, which this year is the 25th of October, I'm pretty sure. And assuming that the virus doesn't stop us, it is an outdoor activity. Yes, so we're thinking positively, of course, and it'll be 10 till 2 our time. And as I mentioned, we have the food, we have, we run sandwiches and the fireys have their whatever. We have food vans there, so there's a variety of food for people. We have Devonshire cheese that comes out of the cake stall type of thing, so they can sit and have a cup of tea and coffee, because a lot of older people, who, as Richard mentioned, who were born there, or whose mothers worked there, or whose father was a doctor there, a lot of those people have come to it. And I think last year we had over 1,000-odd people went through. So it's growing each year in the number of people who come. And hopefully it'll be bigger and better this year.
Richard, the money's obviously happened to some extent. What's next? What's the time frame? When can we expect to see things finalised, hopefully?
Originally, we got a grant from the Office of Environment and Heritage for $100,000 to employ an architect, and the architect came up with concept plans. They were the basis for a development application. We put in the development applications. Eventually, that got approved as phase one in, I think, March this year. The concept plans don't tell you where the power points go, how wide are the floorboards, what colours the paint, where you get the heritage doors from, or any of that sort of stuff. So the next stage is to find an architect to do the detailed plan. That's the stage we're at the moment. That will result in putting the detailed plans to council, and once they're happy with those, we get a construction certificate, and we can engage builders. We'll have detailed plans, we'll have detailed costings, and that gives builders a chance to come up with sensible tenders. That's most likely not going to be finalised until early next year. So early 2021, we will hope we have a builder. Then it's going to take something over a year and a couple of months probably to do the building work, also depending on when the builder can start. So adding all those together, we end up with likely having a building with an occupation certificate in the middle of 2022.
Now, Val, I guess the last thing would be, of course, if there are members of our community who would like to get involved with Friends of the Old Bega Hospital, how might they do that?
Well, it's a very detailed web page, and there is our Facebook page, but the web page is obh.org.au, and it's got all the details on there. This is a learning process for me. I mean, I've diddled around with school fates and things like that, but the amount of work and effort that goes into getting this roof on is just phenomenal. The people that have been carrying that load, there's been a few changes over the time. There's been a couple, Pat Jones, I think, and Jay. They've been there from the word, well, Jay's been there from the word go, from when it was about 1990. And it just goes to show what effort has to go in once this roof was burnt. Just tremendous. It's frustrating, and you don't like to sound like you're whinging about things. But when you see so much of taxpayers' money going into the cities and larger regional areas, we tend to be a forgotten one. And we can't, my comment to at one stage to Andrew, and Andrew's been very good, but one, we can't all live in a city. I mean, you know, and the people of the Bega Valley are entitled to have this community and cultural centre finished as soon as it can, and hopefully, I mean, I would love to see one of the governments say, well, as we're doing stage one, really, we all know stage two, as Richard mentioned, everything goes up. Every 6 months, everything's gone up. Every time, so the longer all these things are delayed, the more it costs. The government can borrow money for virtually nothing now, and, you know, to me, it would be very sensible, as we've been through fires, drought in this area, now the COVID, all small businesses are only operating at half strength if they're operating at all. So the building a hole, doing a whole lot would actually, you know, create a lot of work in the area, purchasing the proper building gear that's needed in our area where we can, creating the work here. But anyway, I mean, it's probably not going to happen, but it's a nice pipe dream.
Back when the fire happened, it could have, and I reckon should have, just been an insurance claim. It's a government building, government self-insured. They don't use private sector insurers. And they should have just been able to look at the building and said, yes, it's been an accidental fire. It's a government building. It's a community building. Here's the money to design, to go through the design process and cost it. And when that's all ready, we'll pay for a builder. And that could have all happened back in 2004, 2005, and the community had its building back in 2006. So to me, as Val says, it's been an extraordinary amount of work. And it does jar that just need not have been necessary.
Val Little and Richard Bomford are members of the Friends of the Old Bega Hospital. My name's Indy Wood, and you are listening to The Local Update, a podcast looking at local issues, events, and personalities from around the Bega Valley. This podcast is produced by Indy Media, and you can find all the info about the podcast and about Indy Media at indymedia.com.au. Indy Media recognises the Yuin people as the traditional owners of the land from which we broadcast and pays respects to elders past, present, and emerging. There's a new episode of The Local Update available every Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. from indymedia.com.au and from wherever you get all good podcasts. My name's Indy Wood. Thank you so much for your time this week. We'll catch you again next time. Bye now.